Welcome to the Virtual Refuge Sangha podcast. I'm Sean Lindsay, and with me today are Kim Sika, Sterling Swallow, and Greg Woodhouse, and we're going to get together and talk about karma, or at least some of the aspects of karma. As we begin, why don't we ask for introductions? Kim, you want to start by introducing yourself?
Sure. I'm Kim Sika. I know a little bit about karma, but I'm interested in today's talk to learn more.
Terrific. Sterling?
Hi, I'm Sterling. I've had a long-term academic interest in Buddhism and just recently been exploring it in the more spiritual realm, trying very hard and sometimes unsuccessfully to build a meditation practice. And so I'm just trying to suck in as much information about this stuff as I can.
Great. Greg?
Hi, I'm Greg Woodhouse. I'm not exactly sure what's relevant here. I meditate regularly and have an interest in learning more about Buddhism. I also have an aunt named Karma, spelled a little differently.
We'll look forward to hearing more about that. It's not at all controversial to say that we have certain capacities which enable us to perceive beauty. And without those capacities, we'd not be able to perceive it. At the obvious end of the scale, if we've never been able to hear, we can't perceive the beauty of a Bach sonata. And if we've never been able to see, we can't perceive the beauty of the colors of autumn leaves. But let me rephrase that and zero in on the leaves. It isn't the ability to see that creates beauty. Beauty occurs in the conscious seeing. It isn't a thing that's out there. Newtonian physics teaches us that all that is out there are particles and various kinds of fields and energy waves. The arrangements of structures in the human retina transform various wavelengths of electromagnetic radiation into electrical impulses. Those travel to the length of nerves, and at the tips of the nerve cells, the electric potential triggers the release of certain chemicals that are received by the tips of adjacent nerve cells, which ultimately produce an arrangement of electrical and chemical information in nerve cells in the brain. Then something that science has no real explanation for or description of occurs, and the physical arrangement of chemicals and electric differentials produces in the subjective world of awareness a pattern. But more is required for a deeper apprehension of beauty. We have to have once seen the bright green of tiny new leaves unfurl in the spring, and we need to have felt the pangs of summer end too soon one year. We need to remember the billion trillion shades of green in all their midsummer variety, as well as have a sense of their monotony. And then in the very moment, we need to marvel at the shade of aspens turned yellow gold, of flame maples turning burning red, of plums and cherries leaves turning purple black. And we might need the contrast of the brightness of newly fallen leaves against the dull, dead browns and tans of the older fallen leaves. For the sense of beauty to take on an additional dimension, maybe we need to remember to trying to render those colors in oil paints on a palette or on a canvas. And for yet a further dimension, maybe we need to remember seeing a loved one newly laid in a casket. And all of those associations and connections and impressions and memories arise linked together in a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a second, and we note that only falling leaves look quite beautiful. The Buddha teaches us that those patterns are not entirely a product beyond our reckoning and not entirely beyond our ability to influence. We have some tools to work with, but unlike a sculptor who works with a hammer and chisel from the outside of a block of marble inward, the tools the Buddha provides us give us the opportunity to work from the inside of experience of consciousness outward. It not only shows us the tools, which are mindfulness, loving kindness, compassion, and equanimity, it also teaches us where it's useful to apply the tools, how to build the scaffoldings we'll need for the remodel, and he reminds us of the need for persistence and patience. So today, as I mentioned, we're going to talk about karma. It's a little bit off to the side of the path of awakening. It isn't one of the Four Noble Truths, nor is it one of the dimensions of the Eightfold Path. For me, it fits into the somewhat peculiar category of notions that help make it easier to make sense of other things. You can live your life on or off the path of Vipassana meditation without ever hearing of or caring about or even thinking about karma per se. But seeing karma and understanding some of how the process that we label karma works in the body and the mind can make it easier to be patient with ourselves and others. It can provide us with greater equanimity in the face of challenges and what might otherwise be understood as setbacks. and it can make it easier to let go of clinging or aversion to the thoughts and sensations that arise in bodies and minds. There are literally as many views of karma as there are views of life, and it can be easy to get lost in the fascinating complexity of stories about cause and effect. So today, as a way of focusing us in, I'd like to talk briefly about a handful of different perspectives on karma that I find helpful in orienting and structuring my own practice. I'm interested in hearing your thoughts and perceptions and experiences as well, so feel free to offer them as they arise. I'll start by talking about the most immediate practice-oriented aspects of karma at the level of neurons, and then we'll move to a slightly longer-term frame of thinking about karma as seeds that get planted today that sprout a little down the road tomorrow or the next day or the next month or the next year. And then we'll expand the focus a little to take in cultural influence on the individual practitioner, and then we'll end with a few thoughts about how storytelling and karma intersect to influence individual identity. Admittedly, this is all a bit of a roller coaster, but let's see if we can fit it together. The most immediate notion of karma in my life has to do with how cause and effect manifests in my body and mind. Even though most of us might prefer it to be otherwise, our bodies are constantly paying attention to exactly what we do in order to guide the body to tell it what it should do. If at any moment in time my muscles are fatigued with a few tiny tears here and there, then my body sees what resources are available and it starts to rebuild those muscles, overbuilding just a little bit more than they were today. And where do those resources come from? From the bloodstream, if I've been eating foods that contain the necessary resources, from other body tissues that have not been hard worked recently, if the bloodstream doesn't contain the resources it needs. The effect of that process, though, is that in each moment of time, the body takes into account everything I've eaten, everything I've drunk, every bit of physical work, every bit of laziness or relaxation I've engaged in, to steer it, to tell it what to do with what it's got. So is there a quote-unquote karma in eating a jelly donut? You betcha. Body generally doesn't get confused by surface-level thinking that donuts shouldn't count or that I added 5 miles to my weekly running distance calculations and that ought to offset it. Karma doesn't think that holiday calories don't count or that protein calories are good and carbohydrate calories are bad. It simply operates in response to exactly what's present in this moment. The framework of karma is pretty easy to understand in terms of a body. But recent studies in neuroscience show us that similar processes are at work in our brains, too, and they affect our minds. When I was a kid, I really wanted a bike. I wanted to be free. I wanted to be fast. I wanted to balance and ride. I wanted a bike. And while I forget exactly what age I was, when one of my birthdays came around in April, my parents actually bought me a bike, and it was cool. It was purple. I wheeled the bike out onto the sidewalk in front of our house. I straddled it, put one foot on a pedal. With a slight push from my father to get me started, I got the other foot on the other pedal, and wham, I fell over. We tried again. And I fell over, and we tried again, and again, and again. Before I started, I just kind of thought that you started pedaling, and that was all there was to it. After the first fall, I was surprised. After the second, I realized it was more complicated than I thought. And after the third, I started to get discouraged, then frustrated. Then I was certain that it would never, ever, ever work, and I gave up. I parked the bike in front of the front porch, and I went up to my bedroom to be all by myself. And I looked out the window of my bedroom, and I saw my sister, who was about a year and a half younger than me, get on my bike and ride it down the street. First time she'd ever been on a bike, she rode it perfectly, wobbly, but definitely riding. That did not help my mind frame. But over the course of time, I kept returning to try again, and a couple of days later, I managed 2 or 3 pedal burns before I fell, and soon after that, I could ride a bike. Neuroscience has a phrase to describe what was going on inside my brain during that period, setting aside the resentment and anger. The phrase is, neurons that fire together, wire together. What it captures is the way that the brain deals with a complicated set of interrelated actions all at once. Like managing simultaneously all the balanced body elements involved in cycling. When I first straddled the bike, I thought it would be like walking, but it wasn't. It was dozens and dozens of small movements and balances. The brain includes, at current best guesses, 80 to 90 billion neuron cells, and each of those neurons is connected to lots of other neurons, maybe a trillion connections. Individual neurons have individual functions, and specific neurons are associated with the experience of, oh, let's say, taste. And others with sight. Others control individual muscles. Others monitor the sense of balance. Others are associated with one memory or another. Others with other functions. When my brain was first presented with a bicycle, it didn't know which sets of neurons to activate, nor did it know how to coordinate them. It didn't have a set of neurons pre-designated as bicycling neurons, but it also had too many neurons, too many connections. Because cycling skills generally do not require, for example, the language parts of the brain. It doesn't really depend on penmanship. It isn't helped by remembering the flavor of pancakes. There's lots of parts of the brain that are not involved in cycling. And so the problem that an unschooled brain faced is twofold. At first, it has to figure out which neurons are needed and might need to connect to other neurons that hadn't previously been connected to make the balance and everything else work out right. But the second is also important. It has to figure out which neurons are not required. Because like it or not, in conventional thought modes, the brain only has a capacity to think about consciously a few bits of data at a time. So as I was trying to figure out how to ride a bike, my brain was identifying the neural patterns required for the balanced movement. But it was also identifying what was not needed. In that moment, for example, it didn't need to think about pancakes. So disconnecting the neurons used for balance from the neurons used for pancake craving helped me learn to ride a bike. The way that the brain does that, so far as I understand current neuroscience, is that the brain keeps biological track of the neural connections that are activated by a particular experience or action. And the more frequently a pattern of neurons is activated, connecting neuron A to B to C, C to D, the more the brain lines up neighboring neurons in the same pattern. So it goes from A connecting to B to a brain where there are 10 A neurons connecting to 10 B neurons, and so on. But just as important, the neural connections that are not used in cycling, the ones that would be distractions from the cycling process, like the taste of pancakes, get pruned back, and eventually they get pruned away entirely from the cycling neuron pattern. Think of it as kind of a self-aware internet connection that sees how much bandwidth you're using at a particular time of day in a particular part of your house, and steadily adds wires to reinforce that bandwidth pathway. And then it decreases the bandwidth of pathways delivered to your broom closet, for example. So now when I ride a bike, my brain is economical. It doesn't trigger parts of the brain that aren't helpful to riding a bike. Eventually, the brain is sufficiently similar with the pattern, that is to say, there are enough neurons specifically devoted to a pattern of activity, that I can ride my bike without actually thinking consciously about the balance, the effort, the breathing, the sight, and all the rest. My conscious awareness is free to do other things. And all that is captured in that phrase that we started with, neurons that fire together, wire together. But also in that phrase, karma is implicated. That's a structure that's a terrific mechanism for learning skills. It allowed me to ride my bike to work with almost all of the actual activity of cycling going on with a minimum of conscious attention. I'm sure we've all had the same experience of being lost in a long train of thought and then suddenly coming back to awareness that we are driving a car at 50 or 70 or 80 miles an hour down the freeway. The brain knows how to drive a car well enough that it doesn't require conscious thought all the time. But obviously that kind of automation also has a downside, because remember the pruning away of awareness. While it's necessary to the construction of a neural pattern, it's also depriving us of information that might be coming in from a wider field of vision, for example. This becomes really important when we turn away from the relatively mechanical efforts, like cycling, and turn toward the complexity and beauty of things like autumn leaves, or interpersonal relationships, or understanding ourselves. Two further details on the fire together, wire together discussion. First, is an implication of this arrangement. And the implication is this. If every event that registers in awareness lights up a corresponding neural pattern, and every repetition of an action fortifies a pre-existing pattern, then every action of our lives affects how we experience life going forward. Let me say that again. If every event that registers in awareness lights up a corresponding neural pattern, and every repetition of an action fortifies a pre-existing pattern, then every action of our lives affects how we experience life going forward. Every time we give in to the urge to eat a donut, we strengthen neural pathways that make eating donuts more automatic, more easier to do, harder to avoid, every single time. The same is true about dwelling again and again on a pet peeve, for example. Each time we repeat that same mind action, dwelling on something unpleasant, annoying, frustrating, we reinforce that mind pattern and we make it more likely to reoccur, and we make it less likely that we'll even be able to notice the opposite when it arises. we will see what we are accustomed to seeing. This fact is part of what gives rise to some of the folk magic understandings of karma that you hear about in the conventional world we live in. You can lie to yourself about the donut, but karma is paying attention even when you aren't. This sort of neural karma never misses anything. The second detail that to keep in mind is one that will become important in the next part of this discussion. One of the tidbits that neuroscience has turned up is that a neural pathway is likely to be strengthened if it's triggered in the presence of strong emotions, like love or fear or anger. And this makes good evolutionary sense, right? The events in our lives that matter the most for our survival are going to need to be recognized faster and remembered more readily than those that don't. Our limbic system, the part of the brain associated with the emotional states in mammals, generates emotions in response to survival-related situations. So our brain is set up to build those pathways deeply and quickly when strong emotions are present. So that's karma as a neurons that fire together, wire together. The next thing I'd like to talk about is karma as seeds or sprouts, and then the reseeding of future events. When you start meditating seriously and consistently, you're likely to have a different set of experiences that can be understood usefully as karma, but they're easier to talk about with a basic metaphor. So you're sitting quietly, observing experiences as they arise. You turn your attention to whatever focus practice you're accustomed to using, and after a few minutes or moments or whatever, your mind quiets down a little bit, enough for you to be able to notice a thought when it arises, or maybe a few moments after it arises and you've gone a little bit down the path with it of one thought chaining into another, but eventually you notice the thought stream. And if you remember when it first arose in your memory, you realize that you didn't decide to extract that particular thought from your memory. Instead, it seemed to arise all by itself. Where did it come from? Chances are, given the way minds work, that it was not a new thought. Instead, it was either a repetition of a previous thought, or it was maybe a creative elaboration or an extension of a previous thought. But since we're interested in liberation and awakening, let's focus on the thoughts that seem to arise without any volition on our part, but which carry enough force to change our actions. If you ever found yourself replaying again and again in your mind a contentious or angry encounter with a friend or a boss or a family member, have you ever wondered why those thought patterns keep coming up again and again? The original encounter was probably one that involved a lot of strong emotions. And as noted a minute ago, when neural patterns are created or triggered in the presence of strong emotions, those neural patterns are set more strongly and more rapidly than those that are created by other experiences. A traditional teaching about karma talks in terms of planting seeds. An experience like an angry argument with a loved one can result in dozens and dozens of seeds being planted in your mind. Some of those seeds sprout almost immediately. You leave your loved one in the living room and storm off to the kitchen. And as soon as you're apart, you find yourself replaying the entire conversation over and over again in your head. That would be one of those seeds that got planted a moment ago, sprouting in the very next moment. Some of those same seeds sprout the next day, taking you right back to the thoughts and memories and emotions of the day before. And some of those seeds sprout a week later, some a month later, and some happen years and years later. If you sat on a meditation cushion for very long, you've probably had occasion to encounter a thought or an emotion that drew you back into a discussion or an event from years previously. But at any rate, you get the picture. So the question comes up, if that's just one of the ways that karma works, am I stuck with it? In my life, the answer is both yes and no to that question. Yes, I'm stuck with the karma of my prior actions, with the conditions that give rise to the present moment. And no, I'm not incapable of changing the situation, because in the teachings that say karma is a seed, and each karmic event of our lives is a seed to a new event in our lives, there's an important additional factor, and that is the teaching that whenever a karmic seed sprouts, and let's say your argument with a loved one re-arises in your mind, if you simply react to that memory moment in about the same way you reacted to the actual historical moment, especially if you feel anew the same strong emotions of resentment or anger or frustration, then not only do you have the seeds from the original event that have been scattered throughout your consciousness, you've just replanted dozens of new seeds. And if we don't look very closely, they will seem like copies of the original seeds, but in fact they're new karmic seeds created by our present moment experience of memory. This matters a lot for a couple of reasons. First, It means that we can become ever more deluded about what actually happened in the original argument, like a game of telephone with our own minds, where the memory comes up and we think we understand the memory well enough, but what we actually remember is slightly different than what the original memory was, and we bury this new one in the consciousness, and when it comes up again, we reprocess it, probably distorting it slightly again, and we plant new seeds, and they come up, and so on and so forth. And so we have the potential to corrupt our own memories, thinking that we're remembering things as they actually were. But second, it also means that if we can change the impact of prior events for the worse, we also have the possibility, with a different sort of mind response, to change how the experience is processed in the future for the better. And it will come as no surprise that mindfulness, and in particular mindfulness meditation, is a key antidote to this kind of karmic problem. Because when we get no real vote about what ideas or memories or thoughts appear in our minds at any given moment, mindfulness starts to empower us to select which thoughts we want to pursue, which ones we want to invest our energy in, and which ones we see as repeating the same old problems. And when we're truly mindful, as soon as we start to see that we're doing ourselves harm by digging into old emotional wounds, we almost automatically start to decrease the energy we'd otherwise pour into them. Instead of reliving the argument and re-feeling wronged all over again and re-feeling frustrated all over again and re-feeling angry all over again, being mindful tends to denature the whole repetitious cycle altogether. Mindfulness alone enables us to become aware of what we're doing mentally to ourselves, and it enables us to apply whatever wisdom we've gained to the present moment. And planting seeds of wisdom is invariably better than planting new seeds of resentment and anger and delusion. In a way, this can be thought of as turning towards your own demons and facing them. And I'll note here two things. The first one is a caution. If you've ever been deeply abused, physically or mentally, or if you suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, this view of karma may make particularly good sense to you, but you should really work with a therapist rather than venturing into taking on your demons by yourself. Because what's going on directly is the present moment experience, even if it's related strongly to a prior episode of abuse or karmic pattern setting. And if what's happening in the present moment only deepens and contorts the prior neural pattern, then you may be doing yourself more harm than good. But the second note is this: just ending the replanting of new seeds related to old seeds doesn't actually solve the conflict between you and your loved one. What it does, though, is almost always really beneficial. It takes down the reaction-oriented responses of the autonomic nervous system, the fight, flee, or freeze kind of instinct that we all have, and it creates some mental space into which your own wisdom may arise. You have the chance to bring natural intelligence to bear, a chance to apply, even clumsily, your sense of compassion and kindness, a chance to engage creativity to find a way to address the problem, and that's a lot, and mindfulness is the key to it. Mindfulness meditation takes that practice to an exponential level, because we can practice mindfulness in daily life with a little bit of effort and attention, but you can actually practice very heightened levels of mindfulness in meditation, and that too can impact the karma seeds metaphor that we're talking about now. Here's how. Usually most of those seed planting experiences happen in the blink of an eye. In a moment, a month after the argument with your loved one, the memory of the argument arises in your awareness. You feel new resentment arise. Maybe you think a nasty word about your loved one, and then the thought's gone just that fast. But that reactive action has planted dozens of new seeds, some that will sprout almost immediately, some that will sprout a little while later, and some that will sprout months or years later. And all that happened while you were waiting for a red light to turn green. But when the same thought arises when you're meditating, you can lend it your full attention. You're able to consciously register the thought, respond to it with some degree of mindfulness, and you can avoid planting new seeds of unpleasant reactivity about the old episode, and that's pretty huge. Meditating allows us to re-encounter those seeds in a setting where we're as close to wide awake and paying attention as we can get. In those settings, the seed can sprout, but it doesn't persist long. One of the interesting details about some of the more recent neural research is that even with the strongest of emotions, when they arise, they last only about 90 seconds, a minute and a half, the sensations of emotion, if they're not renewed or reinforced. Of course, most of our experience with festering anger and all the rest is it can go on for days. It's the actually, and they do go on for days, but Each episode is only about 90 seconds long. What we're doing, though, is we're renewing and reinforcing those and repeating those emotional patterns, and they start to feel like they're perpetual. It's the renewing and reinforcing that we do when our minds get caught in these endless chains of thoughts leading to thoughts leading to thoughts. But each episode of emotional experience tends to be 90 seconds or less. And what I try to tell myself is that I can endure any discomfort for 90 seconds. If I'm experiencing strong emotions for longer than that, then the emotional pattern is being reinitiated by some or other event or mind action, and frankly, I may be the one who's precipitating some of those. But at any rate, once you know that, we can start looking to see if we're the ones reinitiating the pattern. Now, with some of the most deeply ingrained patterns, the most strongly reinforced neural pathways, you may continue to notice the previously planted seeds sprouting for years to come. That's just the results of the way you processed the experience in the past. There's very little that you can do about the arising of the events. To put it in terms that we're using today, it's just part of your karma from a prior life giving shape to your present experience. It's nothing to get excited about, nothing to react to. It's just what is. But by not responding adversely in this moment, you are avoiding planting new seeds of negative reactions to sprout in the future. Mindfulness enables that kind of self-management. But perhaps you're starting to see also how it can actually be helpful to think about karma from prior life activities, affecting and giving shape to the current causes and conditions affecting our lives. So we've looked at karma as wiring in the brain, and we've looked briefly at karma as our personal experience and mind. A third way to look at karma is more macroscopically, at the level of a culture or a society or a religion. Because we not only plant karmic seeds of strongly negative experiences, like arguments with loved ones, we plant karmic seeds, and let's remember that karmic seed is just a way of referring to the mind patterns of those conceptual seeds represent. We plant karmic seeds with every experience that we have, positive and negative, neutral. And a lot of those experiences that get set in our consciousness involve relationships with other people and how we understand and experience our perceptions of their ideas and beliefs and values. At the most basic level, we all live our lives dependent on some version of karma. When we go to bed, we set an alarm to wake us up in the morning, cause and effect. If we don't set the alarm, or if I don't set the alarm, I don't get up in the next morning. I usually get up later, but I don't get up at the appointed hour. So all purposeful action is, by definition, action taken to obtain a particular objective. It's cause and effect. And we're comfortable with thinking of these things in a physical realm. But what sometimes we don't notice as readily is how automatically we apply those same attitudes and approaches to more conceptual and metaphysical realms as well. The culture into which the guy who would become known as the Buddha was born included teachings about lots of busy gods and goddesses. And all the teachings understood that gods interacted with humans in response to human actions. And so as the story went at the time, there were categories of actions that resulted in divine blessings, typically the actions of a priest performing rituals and prayers to a god intended to benefit some person. And when it came to individual liberation, the teachings also relied on karma to guide those. For their worldview, liberation was the result of performing particular actions in the right way to please the right deities. These understandings of karma were part of the world that Gotama was part of. And so they became part of his mind structure. They were part of the concepts in his mind that he used to orient his way of understanding the universe. And we can see some of those in operation in the basic story of his awakening process. You may recall that after he chose to leave his family to seek awakening, he adopted the practices of the holy people he'd seen. He'd shaved his head. He clothed himself in rags. He became a homeless beggar. He performed the actions of a holy person, seeking to trigger the cause and effect relationship that he'd understood was there. That if you perform certain actions, you'll become awakened. And of course, the path that his culture taught him would lead to awakening was not necessarily a path that would happen quickly. The culture that gave rise to Gotama included teachings about endless reincarnations, each guided and governed by the actions of a prior life. So when Gotama turned to these traditional paths of awakening, the karma that he was making wasn't necessarily going to awaken him overnight. And this might also be a good time to note that the culture that gave rise to Gotama, not only was there the teaching about reincarnation that depended on the karma of one's prior lives, but the culture also included the teachings that the circumstances into which one was born in this life are cosmically proper, At that level, karma can take on the role of administering some sort of cosmic justice, or at least allowing the people of the society to let go of their sense of cosmic injustice. Anyway, back to the story of Gotama. Against the backdrop of this caste-oriented society arose a group of people who didn't seem to fit the molds very well. They were these homeless, wandering, holy people. By the time Gotama joined them, and indeed for them, there even to be a quote-unquote them that he could join, they had to have defined themselves, which means that they had to have developed a kind of culture, even if it was only in response and reaction to a different culture. And as these things usually work out in social settings, while the sadhus, and that's the word that gets used for this traveling, wandering, mendicant, holy people, while the sadhus rejected the notion that awakening depended solely on one's actions and the rituals and prayers of the Brahmin priests that one could purchase, they still thought that their actions could lead to liberation, and so they had many, many practices. As the story of Gotama's life goes, after some time of wandering, homeless, he found a teacher who taught him concentration meditation practices. The meditation practices that once mastered by those who can master them bring about experiences of bliss and peace and spaciousness. And there are actions that bring real results. If you commit to the path of concentration meditation, you will experience those kinds of results. There are causes that create effects. But when Gotama, as the story goes, mastered all of those meditation practices that this teacher could teach him, he still found that when he came out of those incredible mind states, life was still comprised of suffering. He was still bound by greed, hatred, and delusion. So he heard about another teacher who the rumors said surpassed even the teachings of his first teacher. So he went to the second one, and he learned still more practices that he hoped would unlock the door to liberation and bring an end to suffering. And the practices that second teacher taught took him to yet deeper states of bliss and peace. But again, when he came out of those meditation states, he was back to normal life. The actions he performed unquestionably had consequences, but they didn't cause the effects he was seeking. So not only did he give up on no organized access to divinity when he left his home in the first place, he gave up on the alternative teachings of his culture for access to divinity as well. So what does one do when the normal practices don't work? We change for something more direct. What does one do when that doesn't work? Well, some of us give up, but others like Gotama double down. He became an ascetic, one of those people who engage in extreme practices, pushing the body and the mind to as extreme as he can get them. And as the story goes of Gotama, he ate only a single sesame seed a day, and he got so emaciated that you could see the bulges of his vertebrae through the skin of his belly. And while I'm kind of skeptical of some of the specific parts of those stories, I can totally relate to the double down strategy for spiritual development. I have a penchant for that kind of a tendency myself. And as the story reminds us, it didn't lead to awakening. He realized that eventually, if he continued that path, he'd end up not liberated and awakened, but just dead. The culture into which he was born taught that what you get from life depends on your actions, whether for good or evil. The counterculture of the spiritual seekers that he hung out with also taught that the main culture's teachings about what causes led to what effects, that those basic main culture teachings were wrong, but they also taught that the counterculture had the right recipe for the actions, for the objectives that he had. So Gotama followed the counterculture of his time, but as he found that and worked with it, he found that it didn't deliver the goods either. So he went the ascetic route, doubled down, that just made him sick. Eventually he did awaken. We've talked about his path on other days, and we'll save the discussion for how his path was something other than just another key to open the magic door kind of practice. We'll leave that for discussion for another day. But the point I want to note in particular here is that leaving home was no escape for Gotama. Changing the long hair for a shaved head, changing prince's clothes for a beggar's robe, those didn't enable Gotama to escape karma. It was the mindfulness practice that we've already talked about that changed things. But wait, you might be thinking, isn't mindfulness practice just one more change of clothes, one more set of teachings, all of which are right in some ways and wrong in other ways? Am I just trading culture for equally problematic counterculture if I start to practice these things? I think one way to answer that question is to recognize that much of culture, whether society or religion or politics, is an overlay on the basic experience of sensory awareness. That is to say, they start with awareness and they interpret them differently based on a common set of understandings and principles. But mindfulness takes us back toward the basic experience of sensory awareness. Mindfulness of the body is the perception of a sensation in, let's say, the tip of your left ring finger right now, or maybe the sensation on the surface of the skin on the right side of your chin. Maybe it's the expansion of the belly during the next inhalation of breath. Maybe you can feel a vibration in your right shoulder. With mindfulness practice, taking it deeper, we learn to notice the very concept of shoulder, which is a cultural concept, by the way, distinguishing that segment of body as shoulder and other parts of the body as not shoulder. You start to notice that the concept of shoulder is different from the minute sensation that we just located in the area that we label as shoulder. And the mindfulness meditation process itself continues, noticing the events we label as sensations, the events we label as thoughts, the events we label as emotions. The process also takes us into perceptions of the valences of events, the feeling tone that arises in connection with an event, whether we experience it as a positive thing, a negative thing, or a neutral thing. This is pretty elemental stuff. And this part of the practice is not, it's not devoid of acculturation of the influence of society and collective karma, but it's less burdened with it because it's closer to the actual experience of living. Now, you can't have spent very much time with Buddhist teachings before you run across descriptions and teachings and the like that conceptualize what we experience while we're in mindfulness meditation. Those descriptions start to build on each other and theorize and draw conclusions. And those descriptions and teachings are unquestionably culture, and derivatively, they can be religion and society, and at maybe the farthest extreme, they can be politics. So while I think there's a solid argument that Buddhist practice itself is not really just another religion, I also think there's a solid argument that Buddhist teachings, which are different than practices, Buddhist teachings comprise another culture or even a religion for those so inclined. The best of the Buddhist teachings, however, hew very closely to Buddhist practices and the events that arise in them. So in our conventional lives, those of us who practice are not at all devoid of acculturation and the karmic patterns of society. And if we think that we're free of karma because we're practicing that mindfulness meditation, we're extremely deluded. But if we're doing it right, we will be freer within those karmic structures. We will notice when greed arises in our lives, when aversion arises. We'll notice when we are confused or deluded. And rather than jumping right into reactivity, we'll have a moment or two where we pause and we see the culture-drenched situation a little more clearly. And we choose how to act within that culture-drenched context where we find ourselves. So for me, that takes me back to the complexity and the richness of the beauty of autumn leaves falling. Understandings shape the way we dualistically engage with the world. A particular set of glasses render a particular worldview, and that worldview renders a particular kind of experience. Scientific materialism is a worldview that renders a scientifically materialistic kind of experience. And a Buddhist worldview certainly renders a Buddhist experience. Every ism, whether Buddhism or Taoism, Christianity or Islam, every viewpoint is a kind of cosmic habit that becomes the structure upon which the next experience, perception, or understanding is also constructed. It becomes the material from which it is constructed. Each of those expressions, perceptions, thoughts, and understandings, when it first arises, it has the potential to dissipate and evaporate with leaving very little mark. But each expression, perception, thought, and understanding also has the potential to become ingrained, habituated, solidified, even formationed, if there is such a word. For those curious about the potential of what can be accomplished by working with the operating system rather than the apps, Buddhist teaching and practice provide a powerful toolkit. Seeing a pattern of karma is kind of the essence of storytelling, and it's an assertion that this causes that. It's always an artificially narrow story. In literal fashion, everything causes everything. Everything that has gone on in the existence of the universe has given rise to your awareness in this very moment right now. Your very existence in this moment can be understood as the karmic results of the Big Bang. The iron in the hemoglobin of your red blood cells came from the nuclear fusion fires of a gigantic star. You are that former star's future karma. Everything your body and brain are composed of was brought into existence and put into motion by the operation of physical forces. Even the idea I just told you about your body and mind being composed of solar products is a story. It's a connection of this to that. It's an assertion that this causes that. We're more or less accustomed to thinking in those terms when it comes to physical existence. Yes, Everything that I'm currently composed of came from something else, and its current location and function inside of me is temporary. And we can tell karmic stories about what it will become when I'm done with it. But we're less accustomed to thinking of our own subjective identity in that way. But really, Sean today wouldn't be Sean today without the sense of beauty that my mother instilled in me throughout my childhood. And that sense of beauty arose in my subjective awareness. It imprinted itself in my neural patterns, partly because my mother took me rainy Saturday after rainy Saturday to the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C. The visits would not have had the same effect if I'd been blind, so the intersection of my mother's actions and my physical configuration were both necessary to give rise to the awareness of beauty. But similarly, a zillion trillion other factors also contributed to the causes and conditions that have given rise to my current sense of beauty and art. A story to sort of frame this. As I think you know, my adult life has been characterized by extended periods of depression. When it was first diagnosed, I went through the usual treatments, and they helped a lot. Eventually, when I found meditation, I discovered ways to use it to address that depression directly. And those techniques, those practices, allowed me over the course of several years to find pretty effective ways to manage my own tendency toward depression. The basic technique is just to notice what's going on when it goes on, to take away the downward spiral to the depression cycle by seeing what's going on and noticing it, and being in that witness mode rather than in the than identifying so closely with the actually depressive thoughts. So a couple of months ago, I cycled back into depression, or at least I started to. And as usual, I didn't recognize it as such when it first arose. What I recognized was the content of the process. I happened to feel acutely the separation that existed between me and my loved ones. I felt the hollowness of my current stage of my career. I felt the loss of sunlight and the warmth of summer. I was kind of in, you know, I have seasonal affective disorder, maybe. But just as this unhappy awareness was shifting toward depression, it ran straight into the daylight of mindfulness, of the awareness that suffering results from clinging. I've kind of programmed that refrain deeply into my head. And as soon as that realization arose, my mind went all bloodhound and hunted for the most prominent ways in which my suffering was a result of clinging. This is a process that has become almost automatic for me, and it has never failed to lessen my suffering when I've practiced it. But this time, the question arose, what would happen if I didn't actively pursue this process? I was a little bit stubborn, a little bit annoyed that I even have to go through this process again and again and again. So I thought, what if I just allowed the depression-type thinking to continue? So I called the bloodhounds back, and I just noticed. But what did I notice? I noticed that liberation kind of has its own force. It has its own momentum, and the depression cycle that I'd succumbed to for years and that I guarded against for many more years, all the way up to this most recent episode, it was no longer a bottomless pit or a dragon or some other dreadful, fearsome adversary. The practice of mindfulness meditation over the past 6 years of my life hasn't eliminated the tendency toward depression itself, but it seems to have changed the wiring of my brain. I cannot not be aware of depression when it arises. And as soon as mindful awareness of depression arises, the depressive down spiral kind of fizzles out. The karma of my mind may always have the shape of depression spirals embedded in it. I don't know. I may never be purged of those seeds, of those neural patterns. For a mind to exist, I suppose it has to have some shape or some contours or some characteristics. And perhaps my characteristics of mind are going to include depression potential. Those shapes are the results of past actions and thoughts and intentions, and they'll give context and therefore they'll give shape to future actions and thoughts and intentions, but they're not immutable. Karmic patterns are as subject to impermanence as everything else, and in that episode of depression, I discovered that my mindfulness practice seems to have changed my karma. I'll pause here now and ask, what is your experience with these ideas, with these karma experiences? What questions arise in your mind?
The first question that came to me, and I think it is based on the fact that I also suffer from depression, and I tend to have a pessimistic worldview more than an optimistic one. There was when you mentioned in the beginning the idea that every time we eat a donut, we fortify our neurons to the effect that it's going to become easier to make that decision in the future. And tell me if I've understood that correctly. But in my mind, my first reaction was, oh my gosh, I'm never going to be able to enjoy a donut again.
which a lot.
Right, which, but I think there's an alternative reaction, which is, that's true. How can I, think about that and use that in a way to make good decisions or whatnot? But I'm just, and I don't know that you can answer this question, but I'm thinking, why is it that I always sort of take this negative response to some of these supposedly liberating notions? And that's probably based on some of the karma I've built in myself in the past, because I'm answering my own question here.
Yeah, you are. I can't call it a Buddhist teaching because I've never encountered it in the words of the Buddha, but there is a teaching in Theravada Buddhism, the tradition that I follow most closely, that talks about three different basic personality types. One personality type tends to be adverse. It tends to view things negatively. One personality type is kind of a positive view, but it also tends to be clinging and grasping. And the third personality type tends to be confused or deluded. It's a karmic pattern that arises with respect to each personality. Some of us experience the world, our first experience of a new concept, of a new experience, tends to be a little bit aversive. It's like, I don't want that. One way of that teachers suggest that you, for discerning what pattern is most prevalent in your own experience, is when you walk into a room, what is the first thing you notice? Do you notice that the room temperature is too cold, or that it's decorated grossly, or that it smells funny? Or do you notice that there's a pie in the corner that you really would like to get your hands on? Or maybe it's a lot more space than you're accustomed to and you really like the additional space. Or when you walk into the room, do you look around and kind of think, what? At any rate, Theravada Buddhism does teach that there are different personality types, and some respond adversely to things, some respond greedily to things, and some respond with confusion to things. There's not none of those particular personality types are right or wrong. They're just characteristics. But the Theravada teaching that talks about personality types also teaches that there are transformed versions of each approach. Those who have an aversive personality type, when they're awakened, they tend to have the most discriminating wisdom, because they're not exactly because they're not attached to everything. They're more able to take a neutral stand, view things objectively, and provide real key insights that way. The grasping personality type, the one that wants everything and wants to consume it, when it finally awakens, it tends to manifest in the form of love and compassion. And I forget what the confused personality type, when it's transformed, generates. But I think it's equanimity. I think it's peacefulness in the midst of a world where greed and aversion are so prevalent with everybody else. So yeah, don't feel bad about regretting that what you just learned might affect the way you view donuts.
Yeah, I suppose that maybe these personality types aren't hard and fast either, because there's different reactions I have when I walk into a room. It often depends on the day.
Well, now I picked donuts for my examples in this specifically because I'm a greedy kind of person.
Yeah.
When I see a donut, I want it.
Yeah.
But then I start telling myself all kinds of stupid lies about, oh, I can have one today. It doesn't. I'm not hurting my resolve to lose weight by eating this donut. This donut is okay. It's only if I have another donut after the next one that's going to cause me these problems.
The second big question I had is sort of when you, and this is jumping ahead in your talk, is when you're talking about how even when we have a nasty thought of a past argument we had with a loved one or something, that sort of nasty thought can can sprout a seed, making it easier to have that thought again or whatnot. And I guess I'm sort of struggling with that, and also the idea that, as I understand the Dharma, that you don't try to push out a thought necessarily. You sort of just let it come in and sort of run its course, and you observe it.
Yeah.
And I worry, you know, I mean, at what point do you? I sometimes worry, though, am I letting some sort of negativity percolate with inside my brain when I observe a thought, rather than coming from a Christian background of trying to push out the bad thought, you know, sing a hymn, get it out.
I think that's a really good and important question to ask yourself in each moment. In this moment, am I really experiencing what's arising? Or am I grasping on what's arising, or am I pushing away what's arising? If I'm grasping onto it or pushing it away, I'm creating more future difficulties for myself, because I'm creating patterns that are going to reinforce suffering or create new suffering. It's very difficult to experience a strong emotional memory or a strong emotional experience without responding with either greed, hatred, or delusion. That's the lot of humanity, and the same is true when we experience memories of them. But one way to work with it is just to turn, exactly do what you said, turn toward the experience and watch it as closely and precisely as you can to see what the experience is. And if you can affect your own mind to choose what approach you have, choose curiosity. Oh, I'm really pissed off right now. I'm really angry. I'm really frustrated. Oh, and because once the mind says, oh, wait, I'm curious about this. Look what's going on. By definition, the mind is not pouring tons and tons of new energy into that old experience. It may still last. The thought chain may still exist, and you needn't push it away. That's just aversion. And you shouldn't grasp onto it. That's just clinging. But yeah, it can be really tricky to find that perfect balance, that perfect equanimity in the midst of a really strongly emotional experience. It's just part of the work.
And of course, my reaction is, "Oh, great! It's really tricky." No, I'm just kidding. That's very helpful.
Yeah, but you just noticed that.
Yeah.
You saw right. The emotion arise in your mind in the moment, and you thought, "Yep, I've felt that before." Yeah. With that, that's a terrific way to discover your world,
right? It,
you know, part of the path of meditation, especially the Buddhist path of meditation, is becoming aware of suffering. It's becoming aware I think during the coming year we're going to do a bunch of talks about the noble truths and how they tend to work in our lives. But the very first noble truth, it's not that all of life is suffering, it's that suffering permeates life. And we do so much in our world to try and avoid thinking about that, avoid acknowledging it, that when we first encounter meditation and we start practicing the Dharma, it's like, gosh, I see suffering everywhere. Well, yeah, it was there. You were trying to hide your head from it, Sean. So Sean had his head stuck in the sand like an ostrich. But it didn't make the suffering go away. So, yeah, when we first encounter the Dharma, and after years of encountering the Dharma, we continue to discover ways where, oh, it's hard. Oh, it's difficult. But actually, it's no more difficult than noticing what's going on in the moment. We tend to tell ourselves stories about difficulty and suffering, but that storytelling is part of karma making that creates our problems in the first place.
Okay. That's really helpful. I'm ready to pass over to Kim for her questions.
I guess I have more of a realization after hearing you talk about this.
Sure.
I'm now experiencing kind of that in reverse. So I'm on a leave of absence from work recently, and I noticed that whenever I experience an emotion that a situation at work triggered, then I go play through every possible situation I encountered that caused that emotion. And it used to be I just thought, oh, I'm upset. Now I'm thinking, oh, gee, now not only am I having a situation cause me to feel angry or upset or whatever, now whenever I'm upset, I go relive everything that made me feel that way. And I guess that's instructive or useful eventually, but right now it's just fascinating.
Well, it is interesting to discover the ways that otherwise completely separate and different events are actually linked together in our minds by our karma, by the accumulation of experiences that we've had. Maybe the only connection is the feeling that we have when those experiences arose. Otherwise, experiences may be completely separate and completely different, but the fact that they both triggered the same emotion makes them linked in our minds, and they start to form that pattern in our minds. That's kind of a cool discovery. I really appreciate both of you joining today. I can't tell you how important it is to me to be able to have people in my life to share these ideas with and to kick around things with, and also just to receive the support from. My mother passed away recently, and I've benefited deeply from each of your support, as well as the support of the other people in the Sangha. So I appreciate it. And in response to Greg's request, and I'll note for the rest of our recorded audience that Greg had to drop off earlier, in response to Greg's request online, we'll be talking about the loving-kindness meditation practice in our next Dharma talk, probably at the end of this month. And I look forward to hearing from you and others online in response to this podcast. And I look forward to the next time we get together. Thank you and be well.
Thank you, Sean.
Thank you, Sean. Can I add that I've really appreciated you producing and putting so much work into creating such thoughtful and helpful podcasts. I've listened to a couple of them during some low moments and found them to sort of give me some peace. And so I wanted to thank you for that.
I'm glad to hear. Glad to be of use.
I second that. They're wonderful and agreed. I listen to them when I'm kind of needing reinforcement, and they help a lot.
It's just the Dharma. And let me just to drive the final point home from this discussion. If you experience those things in your lives, it's because your own mind and your own spirit are able to receive that information. There's a configuration inside of you that has resonated with what you have perceived from the outside. The beauty of the autumn leaves is inside of your mind. The beauty of the Dharma is inside of your mind and your soul. And what you're seeing is and experiencing is a resonance of that as you look out at the world around you. And it can permeate every aspect of our lives. It's one of the cool things about Dharma.